Chapter 3. Mordecai returned to the Free Soul House with a glowing report of Dr. Demetrios's technology, and two of the Free Souls had committed to working full-time on the project, their study time accepted. Emails flew back and forth regarding formal agreements, plannings, and deciding how to best accomplish their tasks. There was little question of breakers being effective and little difficulty in producing it, but administering it was still difficult. Two of George's grad students agreed to move to New York, and their first duty would be adapting breakers to dermal patch administration, to deliver it to the bloodstream in the same way that patches are used to deliver testosterone or nicotine. While Mordecai was in New York, he and George had done a few trials on themselves and found that the patches did almost as well as IV delivery. Now they would have to verify the results and find the best way of producing preloaded batches. Overhearing some discussion on the batches and trials, several of the Free Souls volunteered to be test subjects for the formal patch tests. With no other real choice, George consented and would fly to Florida a week later to administer a couple of dozen treatments and to verify the results. He got Emilia busy preparing the batches and storing them properly. With two people working almost full-time on approvals, it seemed at least likely that they would find a place to pursue their work. The big question was, where? None of them were much interested in working in the Third World. They were hoping for either Europe or Japan. That same week, Philip set up clinical trials of breakers at a nursing home which was being run by an old schoolmate, whom George had also known. The name of the facility would have to be concealed, but their old friend was willing to try the treatment. These patients were all considered permanently psychotic, and their old friend, the legal guardian of these people, was willing to try anything that might help them, approved or not. Everything would have to remain anonymous, but real clinical trials were about to be done. George was a bit worried, but enthusiastic nonetheless. James and Francis slept late and made love again in the morning. Then they rolled out of bed. She showered while he started breakfast, and she finished while he showered and dressed. They told each other how wonderful they thought the other was as they ate their meal. Farber knew that this was the time when he had to explain his life to her. There seemed no way she could know in advance what she was really getting into with him. "Francis, I really need to tell you more about my life and my businesses. It's a bit more complicated and unusual than you might suspect." Farber paused, and for the first time Francis had ever seen, he looked afraid.
"Jim, you look scared. What is it?"
He looked up at her very seriously. "I'm afraid what I do might be too wild for you."
"Well, if it is, we'll just have to come to some sort of compromise, won't we?"
He smiled and relaxed.
"Yeah, I guess we will."
"All right, mystery man. Pour yourself a cup of tea and start explaining your crazy life to me." She smiled.
"Hey, it's warm today. Let's take our coffee and tea with us and go sit on the roof. There are a few chairs up there, and it'll be nice."
She agreed. The view from the roof was unique. They were on the roof of a 70-story building, with a light haze partially obscuring the city below. On three sides were other huge buildings, several of them taller, surrounding them in the distance. The effect was that of living on Olympus among the Titans and looking down on the normal world, which was separated by a haze. They sat down, sipped from their mugs, and took in the setting for some time. They pointed out, through the haze, places where they had lived and worked. The effect of being so far above the city and looking down on it through a haze gave them both a feeling that they were reviewing their past lives and laying out their futures. They just sat and looked out over the world for a long time. After they had experienced almost everything that this elevated perspective could offer, they slowly came back to their previous thoughts. Frances finished her now cold tea and threw her hair back into the wind. She nearly glowed. She sat forward and said, "All right, Jim, why don't you start at the top and tell me what you guys are up to? I'll try not to pass out from shock." She gave him a combination of sly, sarcastic smile. "Francis, we're doing something that hasn't been done in a long, long time. We're setting up truly free interactions between human beings. Up till now, it was almost impossible to do, but the internet opened up a virgin territory for us, a
territory that is a hell of a lot harder to control than geographic territory. And because the basic structure of cyberspace is distributed, not centralized, we have a built-in advantage. What we are doing is a natural progression of the digital revolution. What the governments are trying to do is to reroute the digital revolution against its nature to serve their desire for centralized dominion. The internet must be protected. We cannot let it become a tool of the old territorial rulers. So we are building a center of private interaction where rulers cannot intrude. It was a strange moment when several of us looked around and said to each other, "Oh my God, we can't let this opportunity pass. And we are the adults. We have to step in and see to this. We're here, we're able, and it has fallen to us." He stopped and looked directly at Francis, wondering what to expect from her. "So, are you surprised?" She smiled vaguely. "No, I'm really not. I sort of suspected that you and Philip were up to something, and this fits." "No way. How could you know?" She half laughed and half spoke. "Oh, I thought quite a bit about you, Mr. Farber. But you gave most of it away with your comments about we redeeming the Shlomos. And I know your friends, people like you, Philip and Julia, you concern yourselves with large issues, not with the details of daily life." She stopped, remembering something she had thought about years earlier. "Jim, I'm going to tell you something, and then you tell me if I'm right about it." "Okay." "You more or less consider the time and place of your birth accidental, and you do not want to be a slave to your place and time. Am I right?" He nodded. "Yes," he said. "You're quite right." "Well, I feel the same. You weren't sure that I thought about things like this, were you?" He was too embarrassed to answer. She was correct. He hadn't really thought she would understand, but he didn't want to say it. "Oh, don't worry about it, Jim. I understand the battles you've been through to get where you are, and how no one ever understands you. After a while, you don't expect anyone to understand, and it's too painful to have your hopes constantly dashed." Jim sat silently. After so many years of being the odd one, he had long stopped expecting anyone to understand. Somehow, that extended even to Francis. But she did understand. He almost cried in relief and in appreciation. She looked at him and said, "Now, Jim, how long do you think this will take?" Farber smiled broadly. "How about next week?" "What? You mean you really got this? Like, it really exists now?" "Yes, we do. It's in final testing now, and we roll it out in about a week." "Oh my God, I thought you were talking about doing this in the future. I didn't think it was done." She was apparently agitated. "Jim, don't you think the risks are significant here? After all, every government will go nuts once they find out about it. You can be as clean as snow, but once you intrude on their monopolies of control, they'll convince people you are the scourge of the earth." "Yes, they will." He paused for effect. "Until the people have something to buy or sell. Then they'll sneak their way to our door." "All right, I've seen enough black markets to know that this is true, but you know they'll want to shut you down and make examples of you." Then she stopped dead. A troubled look came over her. She understood Jim's basic idea. It had long been suggested by sci-fi and freedom writers. But something about actually doing it troubled her deeply. "Jim, why does this bother me? I've read all the books that talk about freedom, and I love their ideas. Why then does this offend me?" Jim tilted his head, shook it a little and said, "I don't really know, but I can tell you that it's a very common reaction. Whenever we present these ideas to someone, they almost always begin by challenging them. And it's not that they are curious, it's more that they are not comfortable with such a thing existing. The best I've been able to do in response is to tell them to consider only the facts. Chart the benefits, chart the harm, compare them logically, then to believe the answer. But a lot of people can't do that. They aren't able to override emotions with reason." Frances was uncomfortable with herself. She didn't like having feelings without reasons. And she wanted to understand how in the world freedom could elicit a negative reaction from her. Was slavery to be defended? "Jim, one of your guys must have spent some time on this. Who knows the answer?" "Oh, probably Michael. He's the guy who runs this from day to day, and he's a psychologist of the First Order." "Good. Can we find him now?" "Yeah, I think so." "Good. Let's go back to the apartment and find him. Tough broad, thought Farber, in the language that he frequently used among his friends. There's no BS when she knows what she wants. He liked that about Frances. A lot. She didn't speak at all on the way back to the apartment. All right, said James, as he sat at the computer. I'm putting on a call for him. We have a system for finding each other at almost any time. All encrypted and private. He looked around the apartment. Let's clean the place up just a bit while we're waiting. 2 minutes later, the phone rang and Frances picked it up. Hello. Hello, Frances. Yes, it is. Hi, Frances. This is Michael. I take it that you're a very good friend of James and that you have some tough questions for me. Yes, that's correct. Michael, I need to understand my reactions to your private market plans. I've read about things such as freedom for years, and I always loved the ideas. But now that it's becoming real, something in me doesn't want it to be. Why? My God, I should love this idea. All right, Frances, I'll try to make some sense out of this for you. But you understand that this is not the simplest explanation. Oh, Michael, I'm sure it's not. Okay. Ideas like this stir up a lot of feelings. More like reactions, actually. I have some files on this. Perhaps you'd like to conduct this conversation via computer? Then I could cut and paste from my files and do this more thoroughly and more quickly. This isn't the first time I've answered these questions. Oh, yeah, that would be great. All right, I'll contact you on Jim's computer in just a minute. Frances, are you there? Yes, I am. Okay, hang on. I'll post some reasons why these ideas bother people. Take a look through the list and see which ones seem to fit you. The first one probably doesn't fit, but I'm leaving it in because it does fit a lot of people. Remember also that people don't really think about these things. They just react. First, freedom of responsibility. Freedom is threatening because it eliminates the possibility of shifting responsibility for your errors onto others. Freedom puts you right out in the open, with no cloak for your mistakes. It also gives you full credit for your successes, but that is seldom considered, as the fear-based impulses are generally stronger. Fear of separation. For a variety of reasons, most people have an instinctual fear of being separate. The feeling is that separation means death. This may be true in some rare situations, and was certainly true in the distant past, but it is an impulse only, not reason. Third, rulership as a force of nature. For the last several thousand years, nearly all humans have lived and died under some form of rulership. So many generations have come and gone under this arrangement that it now seems to most people as a force of nature. That which was, is, and shall be. When you mention something different, it causes them mental stress. Fourth, no mental image. Because none of us have ever lived in any situation except subjected to state power. We have no mental image of anything different. So when we start talking about a truly free place with no rulers, the listeners have no image to draw upon. It seems like we are proposing a pointless journey into an unknown and dangerous place. Again, this is a feeling, not reason through. Fifth, group conditioning. A central fact of modern social behavior is that almost the entire populace has gone through 11 to 17 years of social conditioning in the school system. This conditioning shows up in a variety of ways, especially in dealing with authority figures. The conditioned responses are, obey authority, don't cause a disruption, accept the place given to you, conform. The real effect here is the installing of comfort reactions and discomfort reactions. Our system flies in the face of almost all of this. Sixth, lack of critical thinking skills. For a variety of reasons, which I have not spent the time necessary to properly catalog, the 20th century saw a mass movement away from reason and toward the devotion to emotion. Have you ever tried to reason with someone who lives by emotion? It is essentially impossible. These people can be influenced by getting them to identify with characters from movies and televisions or with celebrities, but seldom with reason. Most people aren't fully that way, but modern critical thinking skills are disastrous, and a great many people distrust reason, with full faith in emotion. Many of them are beyond hope of recovery. Seventh, cognitive dissonance. This is what happens to people when they have accepted an idea or series of complementary ideas, then an obviously different idea is presented, and it makes some sort of sense to them. It causes a conflict. This is properly called cognitive dissonance. People don't do well with these conflicts. Their general reaction is to eliminate them as quickly as possible. The easiest way to do this is to simply drown them out by reciting their original ideas and trying not to think about the new ideas. Yes, this is dishonest, and yes, this requires denial, but most people prefer it to critical analysis of their existing ideas and potentially changing their minds. Combining this with all the other items shown here, and the conflicts arising from taking on a difficult new idea, are too much for many people to bear. 8th. Fear of reprisal. This is the simplest one. Think of an IRS audit, an FBI raid, or of Stalin. Obviously, the rulers won't like our free markets. It's not unreasonable to expect that they will take reprisal against people who displease them. A very reasonable concern. 9th. Fear of the world falling apart. The central myth of the nation-state is that it is necessary to hold civilization together, that without it, we would all degenerate quickly into killers and thieves. This has been repeated so frequently and so consistently that most people accept it as fact, even though, if asked to provide evidence, they have none. Actual analysis of this idea leads to a contrary conclusion, but that does not stop the impulse of fear. Very few people have ever questioned the nation-state myth at all. I suggest that you print this out. Take a few minutes and think about it. I'll be in my office for several hours. Just let me know if you're ready. Michael went back to his tests on the Gamma Central system. Just a couple more days, he thought, and we're all done but for the reaping. Francis printed out the list and said, "Jim, could you leave me alone for a little while? I need to go over this by myself." "Sure," he said. He hugged her, kissed her, and said, "I'll run out to the store. I'll be back in about an hour." She sat straight and still on one of the dining room chairs and thought about the points on Michael's list. "Okay, Michael, I'm ready." "So, which ones were yours?" "Mostly fear of separation. A bit of group conditioning and fear of the world falling apart also. I guess some of the rational fear too, but I'm pretty certain you guys have addressed that." "Yes, we have addressed that. Ask Jim to tell you about it. Does knowing what bothered you help any?"
"Yeah, actually it does."
"Good. It usually does, but not always. Do you have some free time now?"
"Yes, why?"
"I suggest that you think about this very slowly and deeply, meditatively. Do it in whatever way seems instinctual to you."
"You know, that sounds like a good idea. Thank you, Michael."
"James said you were good." "He was right."
"Thanks.
Hey, can I make the positive case for you before I sign off?"
"Please."
"People under the rule of any state are born into a life of do what we say or be hurt. They learn this lesson as small children and live under its authority till they die. Depending upon the laws and political structures of the time, subjection to the rules may be a relatively light burden or a brutally heavy burden, but it always entails subservience to a group of rulers. I can demonstrate that a lifetime of subservience is not good for human growth, regardless of how used to it we may be. We should take seriously the possibility that something else might be better. That is what we are trying to do with our private markets. We are forcing no one to live our way, and we are not trying to take away the governments they rely upon. We don't wish to live at the expense of others. All we want is to try a new way of living and to see if it is better. This can be a threat to rulers only if they fear that they are losing their property and their legitimacy. We only wish to opt out of their system, to see if freedom works. Questions?"
"No, that's very clear."
"Great. Can I look forward to meeting you sometime?"
"Certainly, although I'm not sure of when."
"Wonderful. I'll look forward to it." Frances knew what she would do, the same thing she always did when she worked with a big idea. She lay on the bed, arms spread out, looked up at the ceiling. She alternated between thinking only and speaking quietly to herself. After what seemed for a long time, she sat up with resolve. "It's worth it," she said out loud. "Anyone who opposes such an experiment is an oppressor, period. If they cared about people, they would be pleased to see an experiment that might lead to an improved human condition. If they object, they're frauds. She got up, walked into the kitchen, poured a glass of water, and paced the house. Nonetheless, I don't think this is my project. I have other things to do. I'll certainly support James in it, but it's his, not mine. After a few minutes, Jim walked in through the door.
Hi,
she said. Hey, he looked at her, trying to ascertain the meaning of her expression and the way she was standing, but he simply wasn't sure. Everything went well with Michael, I hope? She smiled, which let him relax a bit.
Yes, it went very well. You've got some good associates, Jim.
Oh, Francis, they're more than good. They're great.
Yeah, I think they must be.
So, tell me what you think.
I think Michael has sold me on your project.
Farber looked very happy, but remained silent, letting her talk.
So now I want to know, just what are you building? Explain it to me.
Farber put down the groceries he had purchased and sat down on a kitchen chair. He pulled a pen from his pocket and a pad of paper from a drawer. He started sketching. They began to go through details of identities, communication, currencies, reputation, and others. Francis was impressed. Jim and his associates had covered almost everything, and covered it well. At the end of 3 hours, she was convinced that the system would work. It was outside forces that worried her.
You know, Jim, I think this could work, she said. But tell me, how do you plan to stay safe from the governments? They'll automatically hate you.
Oh, we've got all sorts of tricks. First is encryption that they cannot break. Second is steganography, hiding encrypted messages in larger files like MP3s. Thirdly, we use slight variations on standard internet protocols, which are almost impossible to trace. We have multiple servers. But the really big thing is this. Once they get close to us, we'll simply give everything away. It is all open source stuff. We can simply give away markets on a disk, pop it in a server, and you instantly run a completely private marketplace, all the bells and whistles included. 1,000 markets will spring up in 1,000 different flavors. They may eventually find one group of us, but they'll have a hell of a time getting thousands. Running a private market will be lucrative, and lots of people will want to get into the business. Her eyes opened wide.
So, once it's up and running, you can walk away whenever you want?
Yeah, pretty much. We'd like to be the only market for a while, just so we can recoup our expenses. But aside from that, the plan was to create it, recoup our investments, then split up and go back to other pursuits. We are never really doing this for the money anyway. We just want to be able to live as free men. That and create the coolest new thing in centuries. She ran to him and hugged him.
Oh, Jim, you don't know how much better that makes me feel. I know you guys are doing a good thing, but that won't stop a bunch of bastards from trying to hurt you.
But if you can just walk away? She turned and faced him fully. Jim, this is really great, and I want you to do it. But it isn't what I want to do. He looked a bit confused.
Well, I wasn't really asking you to be involved, although I did want you to like it.
She walked to where he sat and sat down next to him.
Oh, Jim, I do like it. I love it. But this is not my life's project. I'll support you on it, even help you, work for you. But it's yours, not mine. Do you understand?
Yeah, I think I do. You've got something else to do.
Yes. But I'm not sure yet as to what it is. Does that sound crazy?
He smiled, hoping to comfort her.
No, that doesn't sound crazy at all. I felt that way more than once. It's very perceptive of you to realize it.
Don't worry, it will become clear to you in time.
He noticed that she still looked concerned, that she didn't want to disappoint him.
It's okay, Francis. You should do the project that is yours, although I will definitely take you up on your offer to work for me. They both smiled.
She slid down from her chair and knelt between his legs. Jim, I want you to know something.
She looked him dead in the eye, tears rising up in hers.
I know how hard it is to swim against the stream, and I can understand how important this might be to humanity.
She paused, trying to let all her inner feelings, her spirit, pour out of her.
And I want you to know that I think you're a great man. I'm proud to be your lover.
Farber's eyes began to tear, and he breathed deeply. Otherwise, he sat still, nearly stiff. It took him a few seconds to recognize what he was feeling. He felt loved and appreciated in a way that he hadn't in a long time. The sort of appreciation that men always secretly need from their women, and that most men never get. Beauty draws a man, sexual desire motivates them. But for a woman who makes them feel loved and appreciated, men will leave their families and will happily risk death. He cried gently, kissed Frances' hand, looked into her eyes, and could say only, "Thank you." She stayed there for a long time, laying her head in his lap and hugging him. Jim leaned forward and hugged her as best as he could without making her uncomfortable. Finally, she sat back up and looked at him warmly but seriously. "Jim, I want more than anything else in my life to be together with you, and I think you want that too, don't you?"
"Yes, I do."
"But Jim, I also have some other concerns that have to be addressed." He waited for her to continue. She waited as well, looking to see if he was still too emotional to follow her carefully. "I want a family. I want children."
"I do too."
His eagerness was touching, but she didn't want him to be eager right now. She wanted him to be coldly serious. She gripped his wrists firmly and stiffened her forearms. "Listen to me, Jim. I don't want you to be agreeable right now. I want you to pay stern attention. What I'm telling you is something that really, really matters to me." She was trying to think of a way to get it across to him. He was in love, and just a bit too dreamy. "Jim, when you were young, you heard the stories of standing before God's throne with the huge voice booming out and commanding the fullest attention of all the heavens, didn't you?"
Yes, I did. Why?"
"Good. I want you to imagine I'm speaking to you in that voice right now. If I could turn that voice on only once in my life, I think I'd do it right now." A look of surprise and recognition passed over his face, and he stood up. "You have my attention." She spoke very clearly. "Jim, if I am going to have children with you, I have to be very sure of one thing. The day I get pregnant, which we will jointly agree upon, we have to make sure that we have a safe, stable atmosphere in which to raise the children. Everything else has to be secondary. Everything, including even Philip and Julia, as much as I do love them. Can you do that? I have to know this now."
"All right."
Farber spoke softly, but with deadly seriousness. He began to pace the room slowly. She turned, watching and waiting. She barely breathed.
"When we're ready to have children, which can't be terribly long, I might add."
Jim understood. Frances was past 30 years old and really shouldn't wait too much longer to begin having children.
"Yes, fairly soon is fine. Say no more than 3 to 5 years?"
"Probably no more than 3.
"Fine. When that day comes, security and stability take primacy. If I have to shut down other things, then so be it. Is that a fair statement of your wishes, Frances?"
"Yes, it is."
"Then consider it done. I agree in full."
She jumped up and hugged him. Now she felt free to be happy, to exult. She had found a mate, a man she could raise a family with, a truly good man. She was ready to run for her phone and call her mother, but stopped in her place. She looked a bit confused with herself.
"Jim, what do you think about getting married?"
"Oh, that's a tough question. I've actually discussed it with Philip and Julia before, and we came up with mixed reasons for and against." He paused, recalling the conversation, which had been several years prior, and the reasons they had itemized.
"Okay, hold on. We said that in the current world situation, it was good to be married for the sake of the children, but not good to invite the state to be a partner in your life. And we decided that a religious wedding would work, so long as it wasn't recorded with the rulers. Does that make sense to you?"
"Yes, it makes perfect sense. Our kids get the idea of, and the safety, that we are a stable family. But the government still doesn't get their fingers into our lives. It's perfect."
She paused and thought again.
"But can we find someone to do it for us? Neither of us are very religious in the usual sense."
Farber smirked, smiled and wagged his head, made her wait for an incredibly long 3 or 4 seconds, until she was almost jumping up and down, knowing that he was about to say something good.
"You bet we can. Philip worked the same thing out for his daughter. Not a problem."
Frances now seemed about 12 years old.
She jumped up and down and hugged him tightly. So, can I call my mom and tell her I'm getting married?
Absolutely. Go for it.
Something that sounded like yippee flew out of her as she turned around and raced for the telephone in the bedroom. She dove onto the bed and dialed.
Not 12, thought Farber. It's more like she's 10, maybe 8.
His face grew into a very satisfied smile. She was so happy, and he was getting a very special woman.
Not bad, he thought to himself as he walked over to the window. A slam dunk. Lifetime victory. Not bad at all.
Frances talked to her mom for an hour. Then she called Julia and talked to her for an hour more. Jim was pleased to see her so happy and made use of the time by installing communication programs on her laptop. Then he wrote her a document explaining how everything worked and outlined the security procedures. No talking about the system over common phone lines. No communicating via unencrypted internet traffic and so on. Finally, she finished on the telephone. He had ordered Chinese food and they ate it together and talked into the evening. Then they made love till they both fell asleep. In the morning, James drove her to the airport for her flight to her mother's house and to New York for the meeting with her old editor. She promised that she would read the document he had left her and would communicate safely. They kissed 4 or 5 times more until finally she took her leave and caught her plane.
Hey, Johnny, I'm in.
John Morales didn't understand. Tim Nicholson, his partner, said he was in.
In what? What are you talking about, Tim? Into what? Into the game.
Morales still looked blank.
Tango? The internet scheme we've been trying to break?
Recognition spread across Morales' face.
I got in! Remember the graphics designer in Santa Barbara? She got me in.
A response was required at this point, but Morales was so conflicted that he felt blank.
Wow, I'm surprised. I didn't think you were spending a lot of time on that. Well, not that you've seen much of what I've been doing for the last time, but I've got a lot going on. Yeah, I guess so. Like, what else?
As Morales asked, he faintly realized that he was planning to pass along the information he got from Tim. It wasn't that he had made the decision to do so, but that was simply the way he was now. His nature was to protect people from injustice, and that was what he would do. And this also meant that his friend Tim had become the agent of injustice. He recognized these thoughts, but let them pass through without spending time with them.
You haven't been spending your time very well, John. You're always going home at the end of the day. I've been working late and going out to dinner with Assistant Director Jones.
Really?
Yeah, really. We even went golfing with some other senior people last weekend. You've been missing out, my friend.
Well, I guess I don't really like Jones that well, Tim.
Well, you should, Johnny. He's an assistant director, and he could do a lot for you. You know, it's not just a salary increase that he could get for you. These top guys live really well.
Tim was becoming animated, but his voice was becoming quieter, not wanting to be overheard.
These guys eat at great restaurants, drive free cars, get free airplane trips, get all sorts of favors. They live like kings. You've got to get moving. Listen, Jones doesn't like you that well either, but he does respect your ability. If you tried to win him over, you could do it easily.
I'll think about it, Tim. Morales knew that he wouldn't, that he didn't want to be Jones's friend and to live like a king by those means. But he was afraid to say so. There could be big consequences if he did, and he wasn't sure he was strong enough to stand against them. Perhaps someday he would be.
Think about it hard, John. Remember how we used to talk about hot cars, hot chicks, and money in the bank? Well, here it is.
Well, think about it, Tim. But tell me, what about the designer in Santa Barbara? How did you get in? What did you find?
Oh, that's why I came to see you. I got in by becoming her neighbor. I have the apartment next door to her, at bureau expense. I sublease my place, and I live next door to her for free. Food, furniture, electricity, the whole thing.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, anyway, I made friends with her, and I started talking to her about internet stuff. You know, cracks in the matrix, complaining about the IRS, encryption, laissez-faire, all that stuff. I had all the right books on my shelves, talked about the right movies and so on. So she started to educate me.
And she brought you into the game?
Uh-huh. So, what is it? Well, It's actually called Tango 2. Pretty cool, really. You buy pieces from other players, so if no one trusts you, you can't get in. And you have to share their software as well. I guess some of the people who have been in for a while are allowed to buy pieces and get the software directly, but I don't know any of them yet. Anyway, I got the software. Here it is.
He handed this to Morales.
Jones wants you to go over it and learn everything possible about it. Who made it, how the messages are encoded, how can we trace them, everything.
Wow, I guess I have a lot to do.
Yeah, but listen, John, make Jones happy on this one. I'll get him to like you.
Thanks.
Max, I want to get out of this.
What exactly do you mean, kid? Out of the bureau or off of this case?
I'm not sure, Max. Both, I think.
Well, that can certainly be done, but why all of a sudden?
It's just too much, Max. I don't want to be in the middle of a situation that could ruin me.
Max understood. Here was a nice 20-something kid thrown into the middle of a serious situation that was far too big for him. He wants to do the right thing, but the other players are giants. Standing up to them, he stands to get crushed.
All right, we can do that. I can get you out and get you out safely. Have you got some way of making a living outside the bureau?
Morales hadn't thought of that yet. So much was he focused on getting away from the trouble.
Yeah, sure. I could do all sorts of computer work, especially as a network security expert.
He hadn't thought of it before, but he could probably make a very good living that way.
John, wait here for a minute, will ya?
Max went to his office and called Body. They agreed to meet in Max's office at closing time. Max told Morales to go home, take a nap, and be back at 1 a.m.
My friend will be here, he said, and we'll figure out how to do this for you.
As Morales walked out, Max thought to himself, no, it's not for the young guys to take on this kind of job. It's for the experienced guys like me and Body.
John, this is my old friend, Anthony Body. Anthony, this is John Morales.
As he had expected, Barry found Morales to be young, honest, and scared. They made small talk for a few moments, and then Body handed Morales a glass of cognac, picked up his own, and sat on Max's desk. Morales was sitting on Max's deep red velvet couch, the kind they used to use in Hollywood in the old days as the casting couch.
All right, John. Max tells me that you want to get out.
Yes, answered Morales.
Well, I think that's a wise move, John. You've just started, and these guys threw you right into the deep water, which was a really shitty thing for them to do. But regardless, we need to get you out of there in such a way that keeps you safe. I've already talked to my associate, Martin. He told me that you paid him $100 and that he can take care of the situation.
Morales looked much relieved.
That makes you feel better?
Much better. Being stuck in the middle of this thing is terrible. They're using my work to hurt a bunch of decent people and doing it illegally. And they could blame me for their violations. I want to get away from it now.
I don't blame you, John. Consider yourself on the way out. I'll meet with Martin tomorrow, and we'll have you out within a week. But listen to me. This is important. They'll want you to sign all sorts of papers. Don't do it. Be polite, but simply look at them and say, please send them to my attorney. He's handling it for me.
Play stupid if you have to, but don't sign anything. If they somehow force you to sign something, you must make a note that says, against my consent, pending my attorney's review. Have you got that?
Yes, I do. All right. As long as you don't sign anything, you're safe. We have enough of their dirty laundry to save you.
Max leaned back in his large leather desk chair, which looked to be the same age from the same place as the couch. Actually, the whole office looked like it was straight out of a 1940s movie.
John, can you get the new job quickly?
Morales smiled. Called a friend from engineering school and got a tentative offer already.
Max smiled. Yeah, kid, you'll be all right.
Barry spoke up again.
Yeah, you'll be all right. Probably. I want you to remember something, John. You've spoken to Max about an NSA briefing. That could land you in prison. I'm not saying this to scare you, but you have to understand this clearly. Max would never rat on you, believe me. I know this from experience.
He glanced at Max, silently reminding him of some past incident.
And I would certainly never rat on you. The only person who would do it is you. Barry said this in a purposely accusatory note. Morales was insulted.
I'm not stupid.
No, John, you're not stupid, but you're not experienced with these things either. The truth is that people love to tell secrets. Sooner or later, you're going to really want to tell someone your big secret. That's simply human nature. We all feel that way sometimes. I won't sink you, and Max won't, but you had damn well better worry about yourself.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever had an overwhelming curiosity to look into your sister's diary or something like that?
Yeah, I have.
And did you do it?
Yeah, I did. All right. Until you can completely control these kind of impulses, you're a threat to yourself. Believe me, there'll come a time when you'll want desperately to tell a girlfriend, one of your buddies, or maybe your boss. That will be the moment where you're teetering on the brink of danger, and it won't feel like it to you. Do you understand me?
Barry was being purposefully loud and demanding. Morales' voice was firm.
Yes, I understand.
All right, John.
Barry was calming down.
I'm being intense because this is very important for your safety, and for our safety as well. If they find out what you told Max, both he and I become targets.
Mr. Barry, I understand, and I will not rat you out, and I will control my impulses. I can do that.
Barry smiled, slid down from the desk, and put his hand on the younger man's shoulder. He spoke to him like a father would to his son.
You're a good man, Morales. I believe you.
Then he sat down on a chair, next to the couch and perpendicular to it. Max leaned forward in his chair.
All right, with all of that out of the way, what are we going to do about the people who start to get hurt by Jones and his rapid career goals?
No, Max, we can't do that here.
What do you mean?
Listen, it would be nice, but it's a legal risk. We have to keep things compartmentalized. It's our job to prevent the innocents from being hurt. John should have no part of that. He can pass information along to us if he wants to, but he shouldn't know anything more. Everything has to remain compartmentalized. Makes it much better if any of us have to cut a deal with a prosecutor.
Let's say John gets nailed. He can cut a deal to tell them everything he knows. But if he knows nothing beyond the information handoff, we can't get hurt.
And if you or I get nailed for something, they can't get John for conspiracy. You follow? Makes everybody safer.
All right, so be it.
Max had resigned himself to these situations. He considered them impediments to justice. But he was content to fight one battle at a time.
Now, John, if you want to prevent people from getting hurt, you pass whatever information you have along to us. You do this verbally, in a secure location, never by telephone or in writing. You tell us, and we'll do our best to get the results you want. Now, as for Max and I, we don't care if you ever tell us anything again. You pass along information that you want, nothing more. Is this all clear?
Absolutely.
Good. Now do nothing and say nothing at work. Let us arrange it. If people at the office ask why you're leaving, just say it was a personal decision. Apologize them for being vague if you must, but don't say anything.
Anything else on your mind, John?
No, just that when I get done with this, I've got more things to tell you.
All right, but that brings up a couple of final points.
John, once we talk to your boss, you will be watched. There's no way you'll be able to see me. Actually, it was a little bit risky to meet you here tonight. So here's the way information transfer has to go. You tell Max, not me. And once your bosses know you want out, you should stay away from both of us for a while. If you want to pass anything along, do it tonight, or quietly to Max at the bar. You never talk to my associate Martin about anything illegal. You can't tell him about giving us information. He's a good man, and he'd protect you if you asked him to, but it's just a bad idea. Martin hears only of legal things from you. The three of us keep our mouths shut about everything else.
Barry paused for a moment and thought through the various angles that might be played out. He finished with the one that appealed to him the most and which he had put out of his mind till all the other things were covered completely.
One last thing, John. If there is anything you want to remove from your office, make sure you do it tomorrow. After that, they'll watch your every move. Tomorrow is your last trusted moment there.
Morales nodded, acknowledging that he understood.
Okay, I'm getting out of here. If you guys want to talk, fine. Max, you know where to find me if you need me.
Once Barry had gone, Max and Morales discussed the inner operation of the bureau, drank Max's best cognac, and told each other the stories of their lives. Before they were done, Morales told Max everything he knew about the case. He gave him the address of the woman who got his partner into Tango, the name of the NSA agent, Tim's alias, and the name of his front company. The next morning, before work usually started, Morales scanned every document pertaining to the case that he could find. He encrypted them, then placed the encrypted files into several classic rock MP3 files, and emailed them to his kid brother. After work, he went to his family's house and copied the files onto a disk. He took them home, decrypted them, printed them, and sent them all over to Max via courier. 2 days later, Michael sent out the following email. Jim, Philip, Gamma Central is done. The tests were extensive and identified only 6 small faults, which were easily fixed. I told you we had the best programmers on the planet. I gave everyone a couple of days off, with the exception of Richard, who is our guy observing on Spycraft. More on this in a moment. I can't tell you how happy I am to have this done. We've done a great thing, gentlemen, and it has been an honor to work with you. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. I just finished delivering 300 copies of Gamma, both the server and the user version of the program in pre-addressed envelopes, to my friend, the survivalist. He is under orders to mail them, should anything happen to me. The man was a US Marine for 20 years, so he knows the meaning of honor. Also, I helped his daughter out of a serious addiction once, so he loves me. Next week, we'll begin distributing the user version of the program to our most trusted clients. We will be charging a 1/4% fee for all transactions we handle. At that rate, we should recover our expenses in several months. In our favorite scenario, we'll get all of our users into Gamma within 2 months, and then expand our client base by 30-50% over another few months. Our main concern, however, is the quality of our clients, not the quantity. It is critically important that Gamma develop a culture of decency and honor. If we can accomplish that, things look very bright. The goal is to get a group of responsible market operators up and running. Then we can walk away. Now on to additional exciting news. Earlier I said that Richard and I are still working. Here's why. We just got some terrific intelligence from our source in LA. We have the name and address of an FBI agent who's trying to pull off a sting against us. This is great news. We're preparing a counter sting. Now that we know where he is, we'll spy on him and feed him the information we want him to have. As a second level diversion, we're going to bug his apartment with British devices that McCoy is producing from some old MI5 friends. This is fun. So whenever it is that these guys find the bug, probably a long time, they'll think the Brits are involved. Divide and conquer. Yes, I know that this is really serious stuff, but how often does a psychologist get to play spy? Don't worry, I'm alternating my giddiness with more sober thoughts. All right, enough for me. Mike? Mike, you're doing a hell of a job, but you need some time off too. Meet me at Tino's next Thursday. I've made all the arrangements, and the tickets will be delivered to your place in 2 days. Would have been there tomorrow if you didn't live in such a godforsaken place. Anyway, get your stuff in order and get ready for a few days off. Philip. Frances spent 2 days at her mother's like a little girl. They reveled in a flurry of shopping, visits to relatives, phone calls, and sharing of secrets. They did not talk about Frances's original reason for visiting, the article that made her mother cry. She and James talked every night on the phone. James avoided any discussion of Tango or Gamma, and Frances followed his lead. They both wanted to let this be a purely carefree time for both Frances and her mom. At first, they didn't really decide to do so, but the idea of bringing up anything except the happiness of the moment just seemed to go against nature. It was now the evening of the second day, and Frances was to fly to New York early the next morning. When she got off the phone with James, she found her mom in the living room, looking through old picture albums. Mom, with all the excitement, we haven't talked about my article yet. Yes, I know, Frances. Actually, I thought about that a bit earlier today. She put down the photo album. She leaned back into the couch, took a deep breath, then sat up and leaned forward toward Frances. Sit down, dear. I've got a lot to tell you. Frances sat, moving her mind from happy thoughts of wedding and children to the critical analysis of human relationships. She wondered if her happiness with James would affect her reasoning. "Go ahead, Mom."
"I think you know that your grandmother was a very thoughtful person, Francis."
"Yes, Mom, I do. We talked about things sometimes, though. I was still pretty young when she died."
"Yes, but she didn't talk to you about the one subject that she cared about most. Sexuality."
Francis raised her eyebrows and said,
"Oh, please, continue."
"Very well. Grandmother was convinced that traditional thinking on sexuality and marriage was wrong and caused continual damage. She began thinking about it as a young woman, but didn't know where to take it at that time. So she married, had children, and didn't think much more about it until after the war. After all, she was busy with children during those years, with the trauma of the Nazis added to it. But having gone through the horrors of the war, she decided that something was clearly and fundamentally wrong in the world, and that she would no longer take anything as a moral given. So she picked up her previous field of study on sexuality and relationships. She was widely read on the subject, you know?"
"No, I never would have guessed. She made a couple of comments to me on those lines, like I told you the other night, but they were brief, and she never followed them with anything more."
"No, we decided that we shouldn't talk to you about it until you were mature." She stopped and looked a bit guilty.
"I think I waited longer than we had decided."
She was now obviously holding herself guilty.
"I just didn't want you to get into this until you were older, Francis. I was sure, am sure, that you'll want to pursue the subject. And I guess I wanted to save you from putting yourself up for public ridicule."
She began to cry. Francis moved next to her and tucked her.
"It's okay, Mama. If I do this, I'll be content to speak unpopular opinions. Jim has done that 100 times, so it won't bother him either. It's okay."
Marjorie looked at her daughter, clearly and lovingly.
"I believe you, Francis. I believe that you mean what you say, and that you aren't worried about people disagreeing with you, or even hating you. But don't ever think that you have no limits. Everyone does, even you, and even Jim."
Francis understood her mother. But there was something else in her mind. Why was she saying this?
Marjorie was wiping her tears off her cheeks.
"Mom wanted me to do this, Francis, but I couldn't. After the war, I had all the trauma I ever wanted. Mom did too. You've had a reasonably good young life, Francis. Mine was traumatic. I never wanted to tell you about it when you were young, but I had to nurse dying soldiers every day for 2.5 years. It was horrifying. Boys missing arms with holes in their stomachs, missing eyes. It was too much. That's why your father and I always lived a quiet life. We had enough difficult situations for a lifetime. That's why we came to America. You can't imagine how wonderful it was for us throughout the 1950s and the first part of the 60s. A quiet, pleasant, safe and decent world. The Korean War was a bit scary, but aside from that, it was idyllic for us. Mom felt more or less the same. It wasn't quite as bad for her. She was older when she had to go through it. But still, she wasn't ready to take on the world. The point is this, Francis. You're a strong young woman, but I want you to remember that you are not beyond being worn out and damaged by difficulties. Too much hatred and fighting will hurt you, darling, and I don't want you to be hurt."
She began crying again, and Francis hugged her lovingly.
"Mother, listen to me. I understand you, and I believe that I'm not limitless. I promise you now that I will be careful, very careful. You believe me, Mom?"
"Yes, I do, Francis." She took a deep breath and prepared to say something important.
"I think that Mother was right, and that there is something seriously wrong with the way humanity has handled sex. For God's sake, it's the most fundamental aspect of life, and people still can't talk about it without making it dirty and cheap or making it taboo. Something is very, very wrong. But if you talk about this, people get crazy. I've brought this up in conversations a number of times, and almost always I was met with shock and distrust. They'll do the same thing to you, Francis. For some reason, they just can't handle reasonable talk about it."
"Mama, I can handle this. It'll be all right."
"And what about your children, Francis?"
Francis sat completely stiff for a moment.
"Truthfully, Mom, I hadn't thought of that yet. That's an important question."
She seemed to be searching her own mind for a moment, and then acquired a look of resolve.
"Mom,
I don't know exactly what I'll do, but I promise you that I won't make my children suffer for my sake. They will come first and will be protected." Marjorie had been looking Frances directly in the eye when she spoke. She believed her daughter and was satisfied that her grandchildren would be protected. She got up from the couch and walked into her bed. A minute later, she emerged, carrying a large file folder. It was nearly filled with paper, some of them fairly old. "Frances, these are grandmother's notes, my remembrance of our conversations, and notes of my own. No, these are personal notes, so you cannot publish them with our name attached. But aside from that, you can do with them as you want. When you're ready, call me about the papers, and I'll help you understand our thoughts. But darling," she sat next to Frances and held her in her arms, "please, let's be done with the subject now. It makes me think about why I didn't want to pursue it." Frances understood. She put the papers away and took her mom on a late night walk through their neighborhood. As they walked through the empty streets, Frances pointed out fun places from her childhood. It made her mom happy. "Jim, are you there?"
"Hi, I see that my instructions were decipherable."
"Yeah, they were fine."
"So I take it you're in Manhattan?"
"Yes, I am. The meetings were a shocker, Jim. You won't believe this."
"Good? Bad?"
"Good, I think. The story my editor wants me to cover? Your private markets. Remember the other night when you told me that your partial system had been running for a year and had lots of users? Well, they're not sure what it is, but my editor has been getting rumors about an unusual amount of commerce being done off the books and balance sheets showing up out of whack. Is this good or is it bad?"
"Well, like I said, we know the US government is aware, but we didn't think a newspaper would find out. I guess having you as the investigator gives us opportunities, or at least early information."
"Oh my God, Jim, I nearly passed out when Rodney told me. I faked a sneeze so he wouldn't notice."
"Wow, are you going to handle it?"
"I'm not sure. Right now I'm in a state of shock."
"Yeah, I can imagine."
"I'll have to figure this out over the next few days, but I did agree to cover the story for Rodney, so I'll start going through his leads. That means that I'm going to stay here one more day."
"I'll be waiting for you."
"Yeah, me too."
"Yeah, we'll have a bunch of things to talk about." Both of them understood that they were talking about living together, but thought that such subjects should be discussed in person, so they left it unsaid.
"So, how did your day go?"
"Great. Gamma is done."
"Gamma? You mean the new market program?"
"Yes."
"Fantastic. Why do you call it Gamma?"
"The name comes from an old behavioral experiment Michael told us about. There were scientists experimenting with rats to verify their behavioral models. They expected the usual alpha and beta groupings, the beta rats being basically followers, taking the leftover from the alpha rats, the alphas establishing territories, taking the choicest mates, and generally lording it over the betas. But then they found something else. There were rats that established territories and picked the best mates, but did not attempt to dominate the betas. They called them gammas. So that's why we call our system Gamma Central. It's an interaction central for gamma humans. Gammas are not content to be followers and work to get the best out of life. But they have no desire to rule others.
Like it?"
"Yeah, I think it's great. Make sure everyone knows the story." "So, I never got to the end of your story. Did you talk to your mom about why your article made her cry?"
"Boy, did I.
To make a long story very short, it turns out that both mom and grandma were sort of free thinkers about sexuality and relationships, even though they both led completely traditional lives. Mom gave me their notes. I haven't gone through them yet, but they look very interesting. Have you or Philip, or any of your crazy friends, done much thinking along these lines?"
"Philip has."
"Gee, what a surprise. Do you think he'll have time to discuss the subject with me?"
"I'm sure of it."
"Okay, back to my article. I've got a lot of research to do tomorrow, and I've got to start early. Any suggestions before I go to bed?"
"Sleep well and dream of me."
"Okay, lover man, I will. Anything else?"
"No, just keep your eyes and ears open if you talk to any government people. With the information you have, you may or may not know more than they do. So try to hear not only what they say, but what they avoid saying." All right, Jim, I will. Good night, I love you. Love you too, doll. Come home soon.
Philip and Farber were working for a few days at Farber's Chicago office. After a late afternoon run to the local coffee shop, they walked back into the office to find an express package from the Free Soul House. Mordecai and his partners had responded to Philip and James within days. They agreed to all the provisions of the contract, had assembled their team, and were setting up their corporate structure. Unbeknownst to Philip, Mordecai and his group had consulted with Don McConnell, the Free Soul House overseer, and had put one unusual demand into the contract. It says only, P. Donson shall provide additional services to the Free Souls, as agreed upon by both parties. When James showed Philip the note, he frowned, tilted his head in thought, and then said with a half laugh,
Well, they've got some sort of surprise waiting for me.
They reached Mordecai via encrypted chat.
All right, Mordecai, you're up to something. What is it?
Oh, you mean the note we added to the contract?
Yes, I do. What's the deal?
All right, here you go. When you were down here, you talked about some interesting subject. Paradigms, the necessity of production, the early hippies and so on. And Don says you have volumes more to say. We want to hear it.
Well, I'm flattered. But how does this relate to the Breakers Agreement?
It is the pivotal part. No discourse from you, and we don't play.
What? Why are you doing this?
Because Don said you wouldn't do it unless we forced you. We want to read your thoughts, and we have a webpage where we want to display them to the world.
Mordecai, I don't think I can do what you're asking.
Why not?
It's not so simple as you think.
In what way?
In many ways.
You're being vague.
Farber was watching the conversation unfold on his computer screen.
I think you're being unreasonable, Philip.
Jim, there's a lot more at stake here than Breakers. I don't think I want to publish my thoughts.
So when will you? Never?
No, I will. Sometime.
Why is now a bad time?
I'm just not sure, Jim. There could be a lot at stake.
All right, Philip, listen to me. You can't run away from publishing forever. Tell Mordecai that you'll need some time to consider this, and you'll get back to him in a day or two. Then you and I have to talk.
Mordecai, are you still there?
Yes, waiting for you.
All right, I'll think about it. I'll get back to you in a day or two.
Mordecai was relieved the conversation was over. He felt very uncomfortable speaking to Philip in the way he had. Philip Donson was a man who deserved respect, and Mordecai's words were almost coarse. He believed Don that this was necessary, but he didn't like doing it.
Don looked over Mordecai's shoulder and said,
Good, very good. This time we might get him.
What do you mean this time?
Oh, we've tried before. He would never agree. He's afraid something bad might come of his ideas if he throws them into the public square.
And you think you can get him to do it this time?
You know, if we stick to our demand, I think we will.
An hour later, Philip and James ended up in a relatively private booth at Miller and McNulty's steakhouse. They settled for a long dinner.
Philip, I want you to tell me why you've been avoiding publishing for so long. But let's start with this. When's the last time you published anything?
6 years ago. I wrote an article on Aristotle versus Plato.
And I take it you've had a lot more ideas in the past 6 years?
Yeah.
Come on, Philip, what's going on? You have 100 unique things to say, and yet you sit mute. Tell me why.
Philip sat still, head lowered, looking downward, as though he was thinking both embarrassing and frightening thoughts.
Finally, he raised his head and took a deep breath.
There are actually several reasons, Jim. And truth be told, I'm probably being paranoid. But the risks are real. First of all is the problem that I could be wrong on some things. Now, Jim, I know what you're going to say. So what if you're wrong? Do your best, that's all you can do. Am I right?
Yes, you're right, and I'll hold to that.
Yes, but Jim, when I was a minister, I gave people advice that I thought was right at the time, and it was wrong. And you know what? Those people are following my wrong advice to this day.
And you think it's your fault?
Isn't it?
No, Philip, it's not. They asked you for your advice, and you helped them as best you could. What if you weren't there? They might have gotten worse advice.
You're not God, and you can only give out the best you have. Listen to me. You can't hold yourself to the standard of being all-knowing.
Okay, you have a point. Nonetheless, my advice has negatively affected people.
Farber started laughing.
Oh my God, why didn't I get it earlier?
Philip, you're giving me bullshit. How old were you when you gave your Jesus friends bad advice?
20-something.
Farber began loudly and tartly.
Philip, move on. You gave some bad advice when you were 20-some years old, and you're worried about it still? Join the I Screwed Up Club, baby, get over it.
He laughed more, then became serious.
Okay, Philip, has your advice done more benefit or harm?
Benefit.
Then what more do you want?
Listen, you've told me yourself many times that the world is massively screwed up. It's going to be messy no matter what you do. The people receiving even your best advice are going to take it wrongly in some cases.
James had been convincing Philip very well up to this point, but now Philip's expression said that he had somehow lost him.
Philip, you've got to tell me what you're afraid of. Come on.
I'm afraid of being another Karl Marx, responsible for the murder of 100 million people.
Philip was dead serious.
Listen, Jim, Marx was something of a crank, but he wasn't a mass murderer. But do you know how many people were killed in the name of his doctrine? 100 million. These were real people who died, not statistics. Mothers, fathers, children, real people. 100 million of them. Sadistic murder on a suffocating scale. Slow, painful deaths. No, Marx didn't tell these guys to do that, but he gave them a tool to use, and that's all they needed to get themselves into power and to kill.
And you're afraid that your ideas could be used that way?
I don't think so.
I don't think either, Jim.
But then again, neither did Marx.
Whose ideas are better, yours or Marx?
No BS, tell me.
Mine. Why are they better?
Because they are based upon reality. Marx's weren't.
Good. Now what was the real reason the peasants accepted communism in Russia and China?
Well, first of all, false promises of heaven on earth.
Would we do better to call it irrational hopes, Philip?
Yes, definitely.
And what else?
Envy. They wanted to get the share of the rich guy stuff. Communism gave them justification for their envy and for robbery.
Right. And do you advocate these things or anything like them?
No.
So you're being frozen in fear by nothing more than oversized operation. Philip, do you value my judgment?
You know I do.
All right then, play along with me. Relax, take a drink, and start telling me how and why Marx blew it. How you wouldn't, and why your ideas are right. I promise I won't tell anyone you're a braggart.
Philip looked at Jim with a half smile, half frown.
Okay.
He took a drink, leaned back, and looked off into the distance. He knew that Jim was right, yet somehow he wasn't quite convinced.
All right. Let me start with one last cautionary idea.
My ideas are big ideas. If I'm right, big.
That's good.
But if I'm wrong, well, I don't want to be wrong big.
You're bullshitting again, Philip. None of us knows what might happen in the future. There's never any assurance that a stray comment won't lead to something bad in the future. Uncertainty is part of the game.
Again, James was right, and again, Philip knew it. And again, Philip wasn't yet settled with the idea. So he did as Jim asked, and began talking, almost rambling out loud.
All right, am I being the same as Marx? His error was to assume that individuality and self-interest were not part of the human, but were in fact conditioned behaviors.
I say that individuality is built in, but that a tribal consciousness is learned.
Am I right?
I'm certainly.
It's a biological imperative. There is no question about it.
I'm also comforted by the fact that I completely disavow aggression. In my scheme of ideas, everyone is free to follow my ideas or not. The next issue is evidence. Is there evidence to support my ideas?
Yes, there is, tons of it.
And the final question. Say we really do unleash real freedom on Earth. What happens when rulers start to lose their power? How vicious will they get? This I have no good answer for.
Philip paused, decided to say everything he was thinking, and went on. Hundreds of people have attempted to make some sort of superior man. Nietzsche talked about the Übermensch. Paul wrote about people who were a new species, and not mere men. But the people who tried to make this happen always wanted to associate it with some sort of hierarchical group. A state, a religion, a tribal or social grouping. They were wrong. The superior man is made by breaking away from those things, by throwing off all submission to authority and membership in group identities. The superior man grows by learning his own abilities, by trusting and developing his own nature, by reveling in self-originated goodness and love. I maintain that subservience to a group or to an authority is damaging to a man's true nature. The reason that there are so few Übermen is because group identity has been bred into humanity and has become a great wall keeping us from further progress. They are trying to bind the vast human spirit to a social structure suited to insects. James sat in silence when Philip had finished speaking. His face was motionless, and his entire being seemed exceptionally powerful and serious. Philip, you need to tell this. You have to put this into the world. I am your friend, and I'm telling you in sincerity and in conviction. You need to tell this. Mordecai, I agree to your demands. I will begin sending you material within 2 weeks. Requirement number one. All of this material is to be published anonymously. If you like, you can give me a pen name, so long as it gives no indication of my identity. Big new ideas can create big controversies, and I don't want to become a public commodity. Requirement two. You will form no clubs, associations, or any other sort of group based upon these ideas. These ideas are to be left alone and not associated with any group at all. Obviously, you're only responsible for your own firms and personnel. Anyone seeking to create such a group will be immediately removed from association with the Breakers Company and the Free Soul webpages. Should my ideas become popular, there will be great pressure put upon you to form a group of some sort. I hereby specifically and adamantly forbid it. Such a group would not help my ideas, but would slowly destroy them. Requirement 3. My material is not to be edited. Requirement 4. You will allow my material to be used by any reasonable publisher who requests it, subject to the other requirements stated herein. Philip. P.S. Tell Don that he was right, and that I thank him for it. The celebration crowd at Tino's included Philip, Michael, McCoy, Susie Q, Richard, the intelligence expert, 4 additional members of the group, and of course, Tino. They had all arrived at various times from Thursday morning till late in the day. Now, at Friday night dinner, they were all rested and assembled. They all raised their glasses in a toast as Philip stood and spoke. To Gamma, to all the people who built it, to the thousands of independent minds over 100 generations who laid the groundwork for it, and to the better future it may bring. As always at Tino's, the dinner was magnificent but not heavy, with frozen margaritas in abundance. The crowd became more relaxed, louder and happier as the night progressed. Ladies and lads, McCoy was speaking in a firm, projected military voice. None of us knows exactly where Gamma will lead or what types of changes will spring from it. But I want all of you to know that I think you are the finest group of people I have ever worked with, and that we have created a thing of beauty. Gamma is a place where people can rise from poverty to wealth unimpeded, where no king or senator or bureaucrat can swoop in and take half of what they earn. This is a place where coercion has no mechanism, where there is no central power point to be grabbed. Regardless of what happens from here forward, we have created the most moral commercial structure ever seen on this planet. God bless you all. All at the table were moved. After conversation began again, Michael hollowed across the table. Hey, Tino, how often do you get a group of people here who really have something to celebrate?
Not often enough, Michael. Hey, Mike, do you ever get any kind of group together at your place?
Or do you just throw dinner parties for the few lost elk who wander by? They laughed boisterously. The truth was that everyone loved Michael's ranch, but it was very, very remote and made for an easy joke. Most of them were city people, so the ranch was a novelty, albeit a pleasant one. At this point, the conversations at the table went completely freeform, with comments pouring in from every quarter.
Yo, Philip, where's Farber? You should be here.
Yeah, well, he had something else to do.
Oh yeah? What's her name?
They all laughed.
Yeah, well, you're right. Do any of you recognize the name Francis Marston?
The financial writer? McCoy asked. One and the same. McCoy laughed.
Ah, that son of a bitch, I should have guessed. Are they serious?
Really serious. McCoy stood up and filled everyone's glasses.
All right then, to our fearless leader, James Farber, and to the lovely and talented Mrs. Marston.
The conversations went on till early morning. It was a long, full evening, full of joy over legitimate accomplishments. The last of them went off to bed just before sunrise. Everyone slept late, laid in the sun, and took naps. For 2 days, they all slept far more than they were awake. They were making up for all the times they had pushed their limits. Sunday was to be their last day there, and they were all feeling rested and ready to go back home. At 9 o'clock Sunday morning, Michael's cell phone rang. It was Farber. They conversed heatedly for several minutes. Michael made 2 pages of notes. When the conversation was open, he ran to Susie Q's cottage, which was next to his.
Susie, we've got another big situation staring us in the face. Go get everyone together and have them meet up at the dining area.
Susie rushed to get everyone there. Within 5 minutes, all were present.
All right, everybody, listen carefully.
Michael was sitting at the end of a large wood table, alternately looking at his friends and his notes.
I just got off the phone with Farber. He was checking my email for me and we just got big news. Apparently our best source of information is drying up. But he finished by getting us one very large piece of information. The FBI, accompanied by the NSA, will be raiding the Seattle Computer Center within the next 2 weeks.
The table almost buzzed with excitement, though no one had said a word.
Listen up, everyone. We have only a few days to get the most important things in place, then maybe a week more before they come charging in. I want all of you to take a few minutes to think about this and come up with plans. Our first priority is to keep our system up and running, so think about that first. Then we want to keep the FBI off our ass. Richard, give everyone a 1-minute explanation of what we'll want to do.
Richard stood up. As he began to speak, Michael got Tino off to the side and discussed food and travel with him. Richard was being very careful to speak very clearly, enunciating each word.
So, our goal is to give these agencies misinformation. We want to give them information that looks legitimate and that they can almost verify. But we want this information to point them just a few degrees off course. Now, when I actually do this, it gets very complicated. We are using several layers of deception and are playing all sorts of tricks on them. What I need from you are any ideas for leading the FBI just slightly astray, while making them think they are making slow progress in the right direction.
Richard sat down and Michael stood back up.
All right, everybody listen carefully. Forget about your travel plans. Farber will have a jet waiting for us mid-morning tomorrow. I want all of you to take an hour to think this over. You heard what Richard needs, and you know that we have to protect our system. Tina will have all sorts of food sitting on the table here all day long. So, go back to your cottages and think about this, and get back up here in 1 hour. We'll make our plans then. We have the rest of the day to get this right.
Philip and Michael remained at the table as everyone else left. Michael turned and spoke.
Farber was asleep at the switch, Philip. That email came in a day and a half ago.
I don't doubt it, Michael. I think he's been spending a lot of time in bed with Francis.
Seriously?
Yeah. Typical newlyweds, don't you think?
Newlyweds? They're married?
Technically, no, but in substance, absolutely.
Well, then, I guess we have to cut the young stud some slack.
They both laughed.
Yeah, said Philip. First things first.
An hour later, the team assembled. Tino had set up a computer at the table, and Richard manned the keyboard,
recording the various ideas. People paced, hollered out ideas, ate a few bites of food, and mumbled to themselves. Some of them scribbled on legal pads, others used PDAs. This continued throughout the afternoon and into the evening. The plans they developed entailed routing their traffic around the Seattle facility, replacing it with dummy traffic, since the FBI would be monitoring all the traffic in and out, and a cessation of traffic would indicate that their plans were known. Rigging one of the computers to have a faulty auto-erase routine, and to fill that computer with misleading data of all sorts. In order to do this successfully, none of the technicians at the data center would know about their tampering. Furthermore, it was nearly certain that the facility was being watched. They resolved this problem as follows. There was one particular technician who worked night shifts alone 3 days per week. On the next available night, he would be told that a special technician would be visiting him, and McCoy would disguise himself as a Russian technician and make the appropriate changes. Then he would leave before the others arrived. Immediately afterward, the night shift technician would be removed from the project and reassigned elsewhere. That way, the existing technicians would know nothing of the setup. "We do, however, have an ongoing problem," said Michael to the group. "They are able to locate our facilities. When we get back, and once this operation is complete, we'll have to get everyone moving on distributed computing, not just the guys at the Free Soul House. Think about it, and I'll be writing to you about it shortly." "All right. We leave for the airport at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. There will be breakfast waiting for us at 7. Everyone go and get some rest." Later that evening, Michael stopped at Susie Q's cottage.
"Got a minute to talk?"
"Sure, Mike. Come on in. What's on your mind?"
"Susie, I'd like you to take charge of the distributed computing effort." Susie was flattered and surprised.
"Why? You've overseen everything thus far."
"Yes, and I've enjoyed it too. But I don't want to do this forever. And once we have our first and second stage of gamma markets running, I want to go back to psychology full-time. I've got some important research I need to pursue. The truth is, Susie, that the distributed computing effort will go on longer than the rest of the project, and I don't want to take it on."
"How much longer than the rest, Mike?"
"I'm not entirely sure. I don't think terribly long. Here's what we've planned. We will find some people who want to take on the job as a full-time business. They sign up people to keep their computers available to us. Then their companies will sell that access to Gamma. Essentially, these guys will pay people to make their computers available for our use and charge us a fee," Susie interjected. "And once we have all this distributed computing in place, we won't need the data centers anymore?"
"Exactly."
"So there will be no data centers for the FBI to grab? Only a few thousand scattered computers, each doing a small portion of the processing?"
"Right."
Michael laughed to himself.
"Imagine some of the Europeans. They'll have 20 computers in their apartments running day and night and living off it."
She laughed at the mental picture Michael drew, having known many young European guys who would fight each other for such an opportunity.
"All right, Michael, I'll take it on, but only if you help me."
"It's a deal, Susie. I'll give you as much help as you need."
"Great. I'll start next week. I'll post a note to our first-tier gammas."
Farber's jet made several stops, dropping people along the way. It ended up in Chicago. Philip stayed the night at the condo he kept there, and both Philip and Farber flew to Florida the next morning. The Free Soul House was buzzing with activity. Breakers was the big new project, and the Free Soul website their new joint hobby. Dr. Demetrius had spent a full week at the house, administering breakers with Mordecai and chronicling their results, which were excellent. But during this week, an unexpected thing happened. Every person who participated in the trial said that they felt great afterward.
"I felt like I washed away several pounds of mental grime that had accumulated in me," was a standard comment. Or, "I didn't realize how much useless crap I had in my head."
Breakers were originally designed for fairly disturbed people, not healthy people. Since it was unquestionably safe, George didn't worry about administering it to the Free Souls, but he was surprised at the results. When he had administered treatment to himself, he noticed benefits, but he dismissed them out of hand in proper scientific style. He had not expected an overwhelming response from healthy young people. And those with the most troubling pasts seemed to be experiencing the most dramatic benefits. It was at this time that the Breaker's regime was first called the Brain Flush. Dr. Demetrius did not like that name at all, since it was not an accurate description. Nevertheless, it stuck. And more significantly, people began bringing in their friends and relatives for the Brain Flush and offering money. All of this led to long discussions between Philip, George, James, Mordecai, and Don. They wanted to make Breakers available to anyone who might benefit by it, whether seriously ill or just in need of quick mental cleaning. But doing this might give the US medical establishment another reason to oppose them. Worse, it might give that same establishment a tool to prosecute them criminally. In the United States, medical treatments that are not specifically sanctioned are banned. Distributing them, even recommending them, can be a jailable offense. After much discussion, all partners in the venture decided to create a separate distribution company that would be in charge of all shipments, including many that would get lost between labs and warehouses. Their purpose was to help people. Regulations and rulers be damned. The distribution structure would give them enough plausible deniability to slow any possible attack.
Hey, Jim, when are you going to come home from that office and see me?
Frances' voice was a combination of seductive and teasing. She was just about to walk out of the door as she called, but she wanted Jim to be thinking about her. Will you be home in an hour?
No, sorry, boy. I'm going over to see Julia.
What time will you be home?
Good, she thought. He's thinking about it already.
Oh, probably not till midnight.
Should I be careful not to wake you up?
Haha, you'd better be sure to wake me up.
Frances and Julia had spoken by phone several times since Frances got back from New York, but hadn't yet visited in person. James was working late at his office, going over the opening and spreading of Gamma Central. The first users had moved over from Tango, were transacting a lot of commerce, and were bringing their customers into Gamma with them. James had two primary concerns: the distributed computing system and money transfers through government-controlled banks. All of these banks operated at the state's pleasure. They could be shut down immediately if they displeased by ruling groups, and all transactions they conducted were open to state surveillance. Farber had set up multiple accounts in several locations, but these would only last until various governments found them and shut them down. Not even the places with traditional banking privacy would be able to withstand pressure from the US and the UK, if it came to that. He needed a more permanent solution. His mind went back to the one solution that had never let him down. Give people a chance to cash in by solving your problem, he was fond of saying, and they'll run through walls finding ways to do it. Farber wrote a proposal, stating his problem, identifying the risks, offering significant rewards, and set it to all the current users of Gamma Central. He was completely confident that he'd have plenty of responses within a week. After all, there were hundreds of partial end runs around banking system. These guys would make money by finding them, keeping them open, and finding new ones. 1,000 hungry entrepreneurs are awfully hard to stop, he thought. Farber walked home, as he often did, and let his mind wander as he went. Halfway home, he decided that he should check in with Philip. They hadn't seen each other in a while.
Philip, let me know when you're there.
Farber posted the note to Philip's computer as soon as he walked into the apartment, then washed up a bit and made a cup of herb tea. He looked through today's mail and watched the news program for a few minutes. There was no response from Philip yet, so he decided to take a shower. If nothing else, he wanted to be clean and fresh when Frances got home.
I'm here, amigo.
The note was waiting for James when he got back from the shower.
Hey, got a couple of minutes?
Sure, what's going on?
Getting Gamma up. Working on the banking issues, a few other things. All going well, really.
Good. I saw the Gamma stats earlier. They're looking good. A few more months, and we can think about getting out altogether.
Yeah, but I think it'll be more like 8 or 9 months. We want it to develop its own culture.
I understand, but I'm not sure they'll need us to do that. Let them do it on their own.
So you think the impulse to lead and guide is a mistake?
Almost always. Let them be creators, not followers. Followers have a certain mentality, and independent creators a quite different mentality. We want creators, people who find solutions by themselves,
who have their own conception of the right and good, and who are capable of independent, righteous action. Followers don't do that. To get the creator mindset, you have to get out of the way and let them rise to the occasion. Make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, a few months. I'll copy Michael on this discussion.
Thanks.
So what are you up to?
Writing essays, visiting kids and grandkids, and planning my retirement.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah, it's been good.
All right, I'm done for the evening. I'm going to relax for a bit and wait for Frances to get home. She's at Julius.
Great. I know they're getting along well. Cheers.
It was after midnight when Frances walked in. James was asleep, hoping that she would wake him. She did, but not for the reason he had hoped. Jim, can we talk for a minute? The look on her face said that she didn't have pleasure in mind.
All right, what's up?
Did you know that Philip and Julia are not really married?
Well, I kind of guessed.
You didn't know for sure?
No,
I don't think they ever spelled it out for me. But it wasn't too hard to tell. She was relieved that James hadn't known. She had been feeling betrayed.
You do understand that they still care about each other.
Yes, I do. Julia explained it all to me. She's worn out and just wants a quiet life. She's had enough drama. Philip is just too much for her on a daily basis.
But it just seems strange, right?
Yeah, it doesn't fit the picture I have in my head. They act married when they're together, but they're not together that much of the time.
Yeah, I know. Anything else on your mind, babe?
I was sound asleep. No, nothing urgent tonight, but will you need to hurry out in the morning?
No, I don't have meetings tomorrow. I've got a lot to do, but I can start whenever I want.
Great. I've got some notes to show you in the morning. Go to sleep now, lover.
Jim woke up to sunlight streaming into half a dozen huge windows, making the apartment look like it was sparkling. The smell of coffee, eggs, and toast rolled into the bedroom. Though she wasn't quite sure why, Frances wanted to enjoy a traditional morning of wife making grand breakfast for loving husband. James walked into the kitchen and wrapped his arms around Frances from behind as she finished her cooking.
You know, this is really nice. What a wonderful way to start my day. Thank you.
You're welcome. I thought you'd like it.
She kissed him. Go on, sit and get started.
She finished serving the food as James poured the coffee and juice. Over breakfast, they discussed the beautiful view, their plans for the day, and their schedules over the following days. After eating, they cleaned up, and Frances asked James to sit back down while she got the notes she had mentioned the night before.
Oh, yes, the notes. I forgot about that, said James.
Well, you were about half asleep.
Yeah, so what is it?
She was reaching into her desk drawer in the living room, pulling out an envelope.
The notes from my grandmother that I told you about. You know, I put them aside for a while. I just wasn't ready to jump into them. But talking to Julia about the non-traditional life with Philip, it brought it back to mind. Here they are, James. Read them. These are transcripts my mom made of her conversations with Grandma. Margie is my mom. Margaret, really.
The pages were typed with handwritten additions and notations. They read as follows.
Margie, you may think this is crazy, but I'm sorry that I demanded fidelity of your father. I was always told that if he were unfaithful, it would mean he had lost or would lose his affection for me. But that was not the truth. He was a good man and always loved me. He was also a very active man sexually. Does it bother you that I should talk about that?
Not really, Mom. It's just very strange.
Yes, I understand. But if we will discuss the subject, it's necessary. Do not worry. I will never talk about any details. It was hard for him to want sex so much and not be able to get it. After all, how much energy can a mother of 5 children really have? But it affected him. He would get grumpy when it had been too long, and I really believe that it damaged his health over time. And I'm very certain that if he had more sex, he would have been more energetic in his work. But here is my question, Margie. Would it really have been so bad if he had a few outside relations?
I'm not sure, but I no longer believe that, in his case, it would have been an evil.
Mother, you say that now, far removed from the events,
Would you really have said that when you were 30 or 40 years old? I don't think so. For me at that time? No, I could not have said it. I was too frightened. But I did think about it, even then. What I am saying, Margaret, is that I should have been able to say that. That I was afraid of something that was not true, at least in your father's case. That I was trained to act as I did, and that such training does not serve us well. The way people have handled sex is wrong. It does not suit what we are. I'm too old, and I've spent too long thinking the old way to see my way out. But perhaps some of you younger people could figure out some way to deal intelligently with sex, marriage, and family. It really needs to be done. So, Mama, do you think that you and Papa had a bad marriage? No, darling, we had a good marriage. But I know that tying down his sexual desire hurt your father. I certainly didn't hurt him purposefully, but I did hurt him. I tell you, Margie, figure everything out for yourself. Don't ever follow the crowd. Whether they're right or wrong, following them turns your mind off.
Wow, was all Farber had to say.
Yeah, I thought so too, Jim. Do you think my grandma was right?
In what way do you mean?
Well, what if we have a bunch of kids and I don't want to have sex as much? Would you still need it? Would it be bad for you if you didn't get it?
Jim froze. He couldn't see any good way out of this conversation without either lying or hurting Frances' feelings, or maybe angering her.
That's not a very easy question, you know?
She lowered her head and was sad, knowing that the answer he didn't want to give was the true one.
Jim, I want to hear the truth. If Grandma is right, then some of my dreams are mistaken, and that hurts. But I want to know.
Farber felt in a hopeless situation. He didn't want to hurt Frances, and he didn't want to disappoint her. Lying might get him out of it, but she'd eventually find out the truth anyway, and it would be worse then. He was angry at her for forcing him into such a situation.
Frances, why are you doing this? There's no good way for me to answer this question. James, you told me that you loved the way I went after the truth, remember?
Yes, I do.
Well then, appreciate it now. I know you're afraid you will hurt me. I appreciate that, but I've got to hear the truth.
He was obviously uncomfortable and still angry, but he rehearsed his words in his mind only once, then spoke.
All right, Frances. I think your grandmother is right. I definitely function better when I'm having good sex, enough good sex. But Frances, I would never want to hurt you. I haven't even thought about being with another woman since I've met you.
She knew what he was doing. He was a good man. He was in love, and he was being unrealistic. The way that such men usually are. They feel sublime at the moment and see the future as always being that way. And should the future not live up to their dreams, honor would demand that they suffer through it in silence. That would have been what happened to Grandfather. She kissed his forehead, with tears beginning to stream down her face.
You're a good man, James. Now, please, leave me alone for a while. I let my dreams die with some dignity.
He felt very bad and worried about Frances. He began to get up, but slowly. Frances, are you okay?
Yes, I am.
Are you sure?
James, go to work. Come home for dinner and I'll be fine. Please, do what I ask.
He left without hesitation, but not without concern. It was nearly noon before he got any work done.
The FBI raid on Gamma's Seattle facility did not occur for nearly 3 weeks after Morales was told of it during his last week at the FBI. The facility was not a house this time, but an old, dilapidated manufacturing building near the baseball stadium. It was due south of the main telephone switching center for all Seattle, and a number of fiber-optic internet links passed within a few meters of the building. Late one night, a group of technicians working for Michael had painted their van to match the local telephone trucks and set up as if they were doing emergency work. They tapped a couple of fibers and brought them into the building through an old underground conduit. This has been 2 years prior, and no one had suspected anything. As before, the agents had been watching the building for days and made the raid mid-morning on a weekday. The details were almost all the same. A number of careful and nervous agents, a group of Russian, Yugoslavian, and Polish immigrants, a flash raid, a kill switch, and people shouting, "We are not armed, do not shoot," in broken English. The technicians were promptly arrested and requested their attorney, Mr. Anthony Body. The computer equipment was flown to the FBI lab in LA for analysis. Richard's counter-espionage plan worked as planned, even better than planned. One of the technicians noticed that the one computer didn't shut down like the others. Realizing that he had a few seconds and wanting to do his job to the fullest, he threw it against a brick wall as the agents were breaking down the door. The case was broken, but the hard drive was intact. The other hard drives were repetitively erased beyond recovery. The attempt to destroy the computer that didn't shut down convinced the FBI to trust all the false data it contained. A perfect touch. Michael was so pleased that he decided he'd give a nice bonus to the technician once the man made it back home. Body was on the next flight to Seattle and met with his clients that same evening. As usual, he told them to sit quietly and to say nothing that he had not approved. His meeting with the prosecutor, Mr. Ballard, was the next morning at 9 o'clock, sharp. Ballard was a much more reasonable man than Coppersmith. He was new on the job and had been a practicing attorney for most of his career, not a bureaucrat like Coppersmith. Body inquired of the charges and was informed that they were to be wire fraud. "Now, Mr. Ballard, you seem like an intelligent man. You know I'll beat the charge with no trouble." "I'm certain you will, Mr. Body." Barry looked hard at Ballard. He looked to be a fairly open, honest sort. Why would he file charges that Barry would be certain to beat? "All right, let me try to understand this, Mr. Ballard. Wire fraud charges will lose in court, but," he began to understand, "you don't want to cut a deal, do you?" Ballard smiled and shot Barry a look of respect. "You're good, my friend. Listen, I'll talk to you just a bit off the record. This is my case in name, but not in fact." Then he waited. Body understood perfectly. It was the feds who were dictating events, not Ballard's office. He nodded. "Yes, I understand, thank you. Then we will proceed through trial. What sort of bond might we expect?" "I'm afraid that will be up to the judge, counselor. I'll see you at the hearing this afternoon." "Michael, I'm sure you know about the rain in Seattle. Your people are fine, and I should have no problem beating this charge filed against them. But we do have a problem. The FBI is making sure that the case goes through the whole trial process. Someone in their office is smart. They want to see what we have, and for us to waste our ammo on an unimportant case. Then, when they get something bigger, we'll have no surprises left. I'll see that your men are treated fairly well. I'll beat the charges, and I'll try to give away as little as possible. I hope things are going well on your end. Body. Anthony, thank you once again. Yes, please get the technicians out of trouble, and give always as little as possible also. If you need to spend any money taking care of our employees, please do so and bill us for it. Things are going very well, which brings up another confidential matter. We will soon be moving to a distributed computing system and disband our computer facilities. We have two more like the ones in LA and Seattle. The new system will involve many hundreds of operators and dozens of organizers. All of these will be independent entrepreneurs, not employees. We want to put a legal defense fund together for them. We can pay a certain amount, annually, one time, and if they get in trouble, the fund covers their legal expenses. Please look into this for us. Michael." "Francis, I'm home." He had been worried all morning. Finally got busy and forgot about it in the afternoon, and worried all the way home. Logically, he was fairly confident things would be all right, but emotionally, it tore him to think that he had hurt Frances. "Hey Jim, I'm washing up, I'll be out in a minute." Her voice sounded almost cheery. He was much relieved. He looked through the kitchen and didn't find anything cooking, so he began looking for ingredients for making something. He thought that he would make dinner for her. "Hey Jim," she kissed him, "what are you doing?" "Well, I didn't see any cooking going on, so I thought that I might cook for you." She smiled, knowing that he was worried about hurting her. "Well, that would be nice, but you don't have to. I'm okay, Jim. I cried for a while, then called my mom and talked for an hour. I think I'm mostly over it, although I do think I'll take a break from the subject. But I do have other important things to do. Listen, you make us some dinner, and I'm going to pull all of my notes together on the articles for Rodney. We really need to decide what we're going to do." Francis had been working on the material for more than a week. She was almost ready to put all the pieces together and make a series of articles on it. Rodney had agreed to at least 4 articles and probably a continuing series until the mystery was solved. The interviews in New York were brief but informative. She wasn't sure exactly how the information she had gathered would develop into articles, but she knew that it was important. Jim finished cooking and they sat down to eat.
So tell me about the articles.
Well, I've got a fair amount of material together and I'm trying to arrange it as a sort of logical presentation. I need to make sense of it all.
You need perspective?
Sort of. I need to understand all of what is going on and to see where it is going.
I think I can help you if you'd like.
Yes, Jim, I would like. But first, what are we going to do about your gamma markets? I'm convinced that they are not the whole story here, but they are part of it. I'm going to endanger you, so how do I handle this?
How about this? You use your private knowledge to generate your perspectives, but don't reveal it in the articles.
That's reasonable, but what if I get to a point where I need to talk about gamma?
Then you'll either write it or tell Rodney that you can't.
Frances didn't like that idea very well. She thought about it, looking for alternatives and questioning the assumptions she had made. Her lips moved just a little as she mused. So I'm presuming what? That the article would expose Jim and hurt him? But would they have to?
Jim!
What?
I'm going to write all about gamma.
He was a bit confused and very curious.
Go on.
Not right away, but when the time is right, I'll tell my readers what an innovative and interesting idea it is. I'll explain the benefits, detail the arguments against it, and do stories on the people who are using it. I'll leave some of the details out, obviously, but I'll let people know that it exists. It'll help you, not hurt you.
Farber smiled and kissed her. Smart broad, he said.
She smiled back, still not quite sure what to make of Jim's boys club comments like smart broad. At least he meant them well.
All right then, Francis, here's some perspective. There is a never-ending battle between economics and politics, between creation and control. The market and the state fight a never-ending territorial battle. The freer and broader the market, the less the state has to do. And the more intrusive and controlling the state, the less the market can operate. Commerce is choked by multiplying regulations. The crush of legislation and regulation clogs the marketplace till it slows down and forces some of the economic traffic to find ways around the regulatory system. The players who avoid these obstacles become more productive than those who work within the system. This is why black markets always flourish in oppressed economies. Now, if you could track the growth of regulations, specifically in the US, you'd be horrified. Did you know that there's something like 10,000 regulations impinging on the sale of hamburgers? I suggest that you do some research on that for the article and show why people are going around the system.
He waited while she wrote on a pad of paper until she said, "Good, please continue."
"Okay, gamma is only one of the ways around the system. There are many others. A lot of people do business under fictional names or do business offshore. And there are a lot of people who simply drop out of the system for a year or two and then pop back in."
Francis sat up straight. "Jim, I once had a neighbor who did that. He was a computer consultant, back when DOS was a big thing. He quit his job and worked as an independent contractor for about a year. All of his business was done off the books, in cash if at all possible, cashing his checks at the client's bank so they wouldn't appear on his bank statements, getting money orders with the cash to keep his purchase off the books, that sort of thing. Anyway, he saved enough money to buy a Jeep with the cash and for a down payment on his condo. He made about $100,000 that year and paid no income or social security taxes. He used the tax money to set himself up. After a year, he took a salaried position and went back to the tax pool before he got noticed."
"Right, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And there are others as well. The Europeans have been doing it forever. They open up bank accounts in a country with banking privacy and have their investment money held there. The ones who do business abroad have their payments sent to a foreign bank as well. If they ever need the money back at home, they just take a holiday to the banking country and bring it back home in cash. The financial police don't search tourists riding the trains. The final point is this. Doing business internationally used to be something only for the very biggest companies. The governments could watch them easily. Now, lots of small companies and individuals are doing business internationally, and the governments are having a hard time keeping an eye on them.
Bypassing regulation and taxation simply lets people live better lives.
So they do it.
Okay, I'm beginning to see the picture here. How many ways around taxation and regulation are there?
Many. I don't have any real number, but for the person who is swift and flexible, there are always ways around them. The only real way to stop such people is to impose a terrorist police state. But doing that on a large scale would be disastrous. A new dark age. They've been trying to tie all of the government tax and financial reporting systems together, but that's hard to do, and so far they haven't succeeded.
Francis was making notes on a sheet of paper, and Farber was thinking about the whole situation. He remembered one more thing.
Now, Francis, there's one more factor I want to throw in here. The thing that really scares the hell out of the rulers is that the middle class might figure out how to get around their taxes and regulations and might actually consider it.
Francis was in full business mode, furiously writing down the information she was getting from Jim. She spoke to him in a commanding tone of voice.
Explain.
He liked her intensity.
All right. Everything industrial states do is centered around the middle class. They make grand speeches on the virtues of the working class, praise middle class values and all sorts of things. But they also arrange their tax system entirely around them. Almost everything having to do with taxation is done to reap money from the middle class, from working people. If these become uncomfortable and angry, they reduce the tax rates. Or they may keep them relatively happy by raising taxes on the rich to make them feel like they're getting a better deal. If things are going well for the middle class, they find reasons to raise taxes, save the children, and so on. They make very sure that the middle class feels no pain in paying their taxes, hence withholding from every working man's paycheck. And on and on. Everything revolves around maximizing the take from the workers. You know why, don't you?
Sure, they're where the money comes from. The number of middle-class people are huge. If you want a continuing money source, there really isn't anywhere else to go.
Right. Everything they do is to keep them stable, productive, and either too busy or too sedated to consider alternatives. They use patriotism, they use fear, they use envy, they use entertainment. They'll use anything they can. They know that if they ever lose the compliance of the average guy, their game is over.
Jim got up and cleared the table while Francis went on scribbling. He walked into the living room and turned on the computer for her. Then he walked back into the kitchen, took her gently by the arm and pulled her up.
Come on, I've got you set up at your desk here.
She walked with him, looking at her notes. He took the file she had sitting on her table and her pen.
Would you like a cup of coffee, babe?
Yes. She realized what he was doing, stopped walking, and kissed him.
Thank you.
And then she sat down, her mind completely back in her work as she hit the chair. At noon on August 24th, the new Free Soul website went up. The pages were colorful and inviting. The logo was a version of the biggest mural in the Free Soul House. Welcome to Fredonia, with Groucho Marx as the master of mischief. There were brief explanations of what the Free Souls cared about, many links, and the new centerpiece, Essays by Prester John. Later in the day, when Philip would see the pen name they assigned him, he would laugh for a long time. No one was quite sure how PJ's essays, as they became called, got around the world so quickly and were talked about so much. It probably had to do with the quality of the people who first read them. Gary had created a list of a few hundred of the most important thinkers in the world, and he made sure that each of them got a copy of each essay. Some of these people loved the essays, and some didn't, with little middle ground, but they were passed around in many circles. The analysis of the data from Seattle was difficult. Morales had left records of what he had done, but his replacement was not very good at the job. The man was able to extract email and IP addresses, but little data. Jones was upset and angry, but the man simply didn't know how to do the job. After several weeks with no result, Jones was desperate. The NSA was asking for progress reports, and he had nothing to give them. They were making implied threats to remove the FBI from the case and take it over themselves. Jones walked to Van Zandt's office, asking again if he found anyone who could do the work. Van Zandt shook his head.
No, I don't have anyone. This was special stuff, and Morales was pretty much the only guy we had. His partner Nicholson can do it fairly well, I think. No, he can't.
Nicholson is good at what he does, but cracking the file was Morale's thing.
Do you think you could get him back?
Jones was angry at Van Zandt for even asking. Not only did he consider Morale's disloyal, but the fact that he had quit over the misuse of warrants had created a stir in the Bureau. The separation agreements made it certain that Morales wouldn't make it a public story, but it also left him with a big story he could tell and back up against the agency. Jones knew all this and knew that he needed Morales and knew that Morales was separated from the Bureau for good. No, the legal stuff is just too thick. He'll never be an agent again. Van Zandt thought for a moment, then said,
So bring him back as a consultant.
What?
You remember the Chinese guy who was an expert in stab wounds? We used him on that kidnapping case.
Yes.
He wasn't an agent. He was a consultant. Is there any reasons you couldn't do that with Morales?
You mean aside from the fact that I hate him? No, I don't think so. Jones pulled out his cell phone and began to dial the number. You know what, Van Zandt?
What's that, boss?
Every now and then you have your moments.
The phone rang as all hands at Max's tavern were preparing for the evening rush, about 4 p.m.
Max, you got a minute?
It was Body.
Yeah, I guess so.
Max hollered an order to one of his workers and said,
Go on.
You'll love this, Max. The Bureau just called Morales' lawyer, my associate Martin. They want him to come back to the Bureau as a consultant.
No shit.
No shit.
They must need him bad.
Yeah. But Tony, can the kid do it without getting back in over his head?
He can if I write the contract.
Hot damn. All right then. Does he want to do it?
Well, he has mixed feelings, but they're offering him good money.
Well, you tell him that I said he should do it, provided you sign off on it.
Will do. Okay, I've got to go. Just wanted to give you a heads up. Ciao.
Philip, you're there?
Yeah, Michael, what's up?
Oh, I'm planning my career.
Ah, yeah, I knew you'd get back to psychology as soon as you could. Are things going that smoothly for us now?
Well, how about 12,000 users on Gamma? We're closing down Tango soon.
Michael, that's absolutely magnificent. I can't tell how proud I am to have been associated with this.
Yeah, I know how you feel.
How are you doing for money?
At the current levels, 2 more months and we break even.
Fantastic. All right, how about the distributed computing business?
I've got Susie working on it. McCoy gave her a bunch of leads, and she got a couple of dozen guys falling all over themselves to get into the business. You realize that an ambitious person could easily make $100,000 a year at this while traveling the world.
Well, we should have no shortage of takers.
Not at all. The software is in beta and should be ready for distribution in a week or so. After that, we don't have a hell of a lot to do.
So, what are the guys planning to do with the rest of their lives?
Well, the Free Soul guys are going to take a few extra classes and finishing up their degrees. The rest of them are thinking of going back to what they did before, except part-time. I think they've all had a good taste of living large. And while they like their careers, they also want to do something daring and exciting.
That's very interesting.
Can you hold on for 5 minutes while I make a phone call?
Sure, I've got a little bit of cleaning to do. I'll check back in a few minutes.
Philip picked up his secure cell phone and called Farber. They spoke for several minutes, making notes and calculations.
Mike, you're there?
2 minutes later, Michael responded.
Yeah, Philip, what's up?
I talked with Farber. We've got an idea you might be interested in.
Well, you can go ahead. I'm pretty well set with going back into psychology.
No, you misunderstand. I mean you, plural, all of you guys.
Ah, then do tell.
All right, here it is. First, Farber sets up investment accounts for all of us. And yes, he has agreed to manage them. Once we've all broken even, we begin to put our additional money into those accounts. Over time, we should build up a lot of money. Third, we'll set up one other account, a fund for financing the next great idea. Gamma's done, but there will certainly be another exciting idea coming down the road soon. This fund will get us ready for it, and also make sure that we'll all have the opportunity to be involved.
Talk to the guys about this, Mike. I'll bet they like it.
I know they'll like it, but contribution to the special fund will have to be voluntarily.
Certainly. Okay, but this assumes keeping Gamma as a monopoly for a longer time, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so. Even when we have competition, we'll still be the most established market, and probably the best.
All right, I'll work on that. But now, back to the first subject, my career. I want you to set up a meeting for me with Dr. Demetrius. I want to go over his research, and I have some interesting ideas for him. Any time after next week will be fine.
All right, I can do that. Hang on a moment while I check my calendar.
Okay, you show up in Chicago 2 weeks from tomorrow, and I'll get us to New York the next day. Deal?
Deal. Listen, the night we're in Chicago, how about a dinner? You, me, Julia, Francis, and Farber. Can you do it?
I'll set it up. See ya.
Activity at the Free Soul House was high. A few batches of Breaker's patches had been diverted to the house and were sold to friends. More people were asking. In addition, the website was beginning to get significant traffic. The first Prester John essay had evidently been passed around in a couple of seminars, and they had received a number of questions from theology students. Gary prepared a question and answer section for the site. But more traffic was not all that was resulting from the essays on freesouls.biz. They were getting essays regularly from Philip and were passing them out around the house before posting them to the web. Gary's habit was to leave a stack of them on the dining room and kitchen tables so that the free souls would pick them up upon returning from their classes or errands. Most nights found several of them discussing the ideas PJ had raised. They examined the ideas and argued for and against them passionately. All of these things led to a much increased energy level in the house. Some of them brought friends to take part in the discussions. A number of theology students came, business students came, musicians and artists came. Some were drawn by the ideas, some by the energy and aliveness of the house. A few came to find a cute guy or girl. Some nights at the house were quiet and uneventful. More nights were electric. Michael Anderson arrived at O'Hare Airport in Chicago a few minutes past noon. A well-dressed chauffeur, carrying a sign with his name on it, met him as he stepped out of the jetway.
"I'm Michael Anderson."
"Yes, sir. Mr. Donson sent me. May I take your bag?"
Michael had lived in Chicago for several years during college and intended on using the afternoon to visit his old hangouts. After checking into his hotel, he had the driver take him to the old neighborhood in Hyde Park where he lived during grad school. He walked the streets, ate at his favorite hot dog stand, and wandered the University of Chicago campus. Most of the old places were essentially the same, though a few had changed. He even stopped by the office of Professor Milton, his favorite. The professor was not in, so he scribbled a short note and slid it through the brass mail slot of the heavy old wooden door with pebbled glass. The note said that Michael hoped that Professor was feeling well, and that he would be calling soon to discuss new ideas. At about 5 p.m., Michael hailed a cab and headed back to the hotel. He didn't even mind the traffic. It slowed the trip enough that he was able to get a good look at the city as they made their way back to Chicago's downtown. The Loop. Back at the hotel, a message was waiting. "Dinner at Red Sea Restaurant, 8 o'clock. Michael checked his email and ran down to the health club for a fast workout. Then he showered, dressed, and relaxed until it was time to head to the restaurant. Red Sea was run by a single Ethiopian family. The decor was the best they could afford, and a cousin provided live music on the weekends. The food was authentic and very good. It was served in traditional style, no utensils, with large, thin pieces of bread used to pick up the food. Philip ordered a few appetizers and two bottles of the traditional honey wine. Then he introduced Michael to Francis, who had been in the ladies' room with Julia.
"Michael, I'm very pleased to meet you."
"Likewise."
Michael Anderson was the child of pioneering Americans. His great-grandparents had gone west from Iowa in a covered wagon, survived a small Indian attack, and settled in an empty area of Colorado. They carved out a ranch and raised a family. The next two generations expanded the family holdings and improved the business, so that Michael was born into a wealthy family, with the Colorado ranches run by his wing of the clan and the Nebraska farms run by a different branch. He had always felt like he had been born into the aristocracy of the West, which in many ways he had. As a boy,
He learned to appreciate the advantages that were afforded him by his family's work, but he was unhappy sitting still. He remembered looking at a picture of his great-grandparents and their ramshackled first house in Colorado. The old wagons could be seen at the edge of the photo. Somehow, and he was still not sure how, he got the impression that it was time for an Anderson to get back into pioneering, to get out onto the trail and to venture further. The intervening generations had done well by creating a good and comfortable existence for their family, but it was now time to go pioneering again, and it was he, Michael Anderson, that should be the first on the road. Physically, Michael was a classic child of the West. A bit over 6 feet tall, a mix of Nordic and Germanic features, and a hair that alternated between dark blonde and light brown, depending on the amount of sunlight it had seen. He was in his mid-30s, never married, and thinking about a family quite a bit of late. Late marriages had always been common among the Andersons, certainly among the men. Great-grandfather was 36 when he married. Great-grandmother had been 24. His grandparents and parents married almost as late. This seemed to be his time. As he began to mature, Michael faced a dilemma that took him years to transcend. He felt born to be a pioneer, yet there was nowhere left to go. By the time he was born, the only uninhabited lands on Earth were in places like Antarctica or in portions of Siberia, certainly not places where one would want to carve out a new life. Every piece of ground on the planet was owned and controlled by some country. If a place was not wild and new, it didn't qualify for pioneering. This bothered Michael. The possibility of space exploration, private space pioneering, really, excited him significantly. But it didn't seem that it would be possible anytime soon. He wanted to go, not as some far-off time, but now. Psychology became his love during high school. He discovered the murky science in a very basic class that he took instead of history in his junior year. His teacher was a retired clinical psychologist and constantly illustrated the ideas presented in the course book with stories of real patients. What impressed him was that when intelligently applied, the theories correctly predicted human behavior. The human psyche had been a mystery to Michael. He began wondering about it as a child, when he saw people doing things that seemed to make no sense. As he looked at them objectively, the actions were counterproductive. But something made the person do it anyway. Something unseen and inside of that person. In retrospect, it seemed obvious that psychology gave Michael a way to explore some undiscovered country, but at the time he remained in mourning over having no new lands to conquer. Tango and Gamma began as pure excitement for Michael, and he revelled in the pioneering aspects of the project. But now, as it neared completion, he really wanted to get back into psychology and to explore new ideas. Frances sipped the honey wine. Something she had never had before.
Hey, this is good.
Jim smiled.
What, you thought we'd take you out for bad food and wine?
Yeah, yeah. Now she turned away from Jim and toward Michael and Philip, who were to her left.
So, Michael, Jim gave me a little bit of background on you, but I never heard how did you meet these guys.
Oh, you didn't know? Philip and I took a couple of classes together at the University of Chicago.
Really? Psychology classes?
Yep. There were some tremendous teachers at UC then. Some of them are still there. Anyway, we were in the same class and studied together sometimes. To a farm boy from Colorado. Philip was pretty interesting. And, said Philip with a wry smile, Michael helped me with my homework.
Francis looked at him suspiciously. I know how you study, Philip. I'd be surprised if you needed too much help.
Oh, no, I really did. Remember, this was years ago. And my kids were young. I barely had time to sleep, so my studying at that time had to fit into any available time slot.
And there weren't many of them, added Julia. He had two jobs and college, all going at the same time. Plus the kids. It was pretty crazy. I still wonder how we did it.
Michael picked back up. So anyway, we used to study together and Julia would make us cookies and coffee. Do you still make those funny oatmeal cookies I like, Julia?
She laughed. No, Michael, I don't think I've made them in 10 years. But I'll tell you what, I'll make some for you soon and mail them to you.
He blew her a kiss. Madame, you are wonderful. Julia giggled. The appetizers came, and it was time to order. Everyone at the table gave Michael advice on what to get. After trying most of the appetizers, Francis turned to Michael.
So, Michael, where are you going to New York?
Oh, I want to talk to Dr. Demetrius and to see his lab. This is a really interesting development, you know.
Actually, Michael, I don't know.
Jim had told me some of the basics, removing the chemical residues from intense emotions, but I'm not exactly sure why it's a big deal.
Well, I'll be glad to explain it to you, but I'm not sure I want to monopolize the conversation.
Philip, James, and Julia looked at each other as if to say, okay with you? They all nodded to each other, and Julia said,
if you don't mind, Mike, I think we'd like to hear it. Myself, I've been trying to stay out of Philip's projects, but this one interests me.
James jumped into the discussion.
Hey, Philip, tell them what the college kids are calling it.
Philip laughed.
Ha, they call it the brain flush.
Everyone at the table either smiled or laughed. Michael chuckled and then said,
well, that's cute, but not accurate. Although I'm sure that's how it feels.
Anyway, the reason it's so important is that it clears out a lot of the things that clog up human thinking and repressed emotions. It's not a miraculous thing that way, but it's very helpful. And anything that can help minimize fear is hugely important.
Minimize fear? Asked Francis.
Well, the effects of fear might be more correct. But essentially, yes. Fear is a much bigger subject than most people realize. Fear is frequently the primary cause of human action. Really, it is the underpinning of a great deal of human behavior and consciousness. We learn to repress our consciousness of fear so that we can reason. Fear is involuntary and causes involuntary reactions. In order to respond rationally, we must learn to stop the fear response. What Breaker seems to do is to eliminate the residual fear.
Francis wasn't sure she agreed.
Michael, are you sure that this is right? That there is residual fear? After I'm done being scared, it seems like it goes away completely. Isn't that true?
No, Francis, it isn't completely true. Let's see, how can I explain this well? You've had a cup of coffee that had grounds left over in the bottom of the cup when you were done, right?
Sure.
All right, say that you refilled the cup and had more grounds when you finished drinking that one. After 3 or 4 cups, you'd have a lot of grounds.
Of course.
Okay, that's almost exactly how it is with fear. The coffee is the fear and the cup is you. The liquid coffee is removed, but the grounds remain. That's the residual. Now here's the important part. So long as you have those grounds in the cup, anything else you put in it will pick up the coffee taste. That's how it is with the fear residual. It gives a bit of flavor to everything else you take into yourself. And that's why people who try Breakers called it the brain flush. Scientifically, that's not correct, but experientially, it is.
So are you going to try it, Mike?
Philip was smiling at him.
Yeah, I am.
Good. Let me know what you think, and if you like it, I'll do it too.
Great.
The food arrived, and they moved on to discussions of family, children, and travel. Julie asked Michael when he was going to get married and what kind of girl he was looking for. He answered her honestly, but didn't give any more information than what was specifically requested. There was no embarrassment involved, just that Michael was raised with the idea that private things should stay private. And while he didn't hold rigidly to that idea, he was nonetheless more comfortable keeping personal things private. Halfway through the main course, Julia looked at Philip. Her face, and especially her eyes, told him that she was stepping out of her comfort zone to ask something, that it was important, and that he should not get overly intense when he answered.
What do you think about fear, Philip?
James was surprised to hear Julia ask.
Francis watched also.
She wanted to understand Julia and her discomfort with Philip. Philip was definitely not an unkind or domineering man, yet Julia sometimes seemed to feel that he was imposing his will upon her. She wondered if it might have been the result of Philip's natural enthusiasm and Julia feeling like she got run over by it.
Well,
Philip was speaking slowly and with minimal emotion.
I agree with Michael. Fear is a major factor in human thinking. In many ways, it is the great enemy of mankind. And Mike is also right that reasoned thinking requires the suppression of fear. Actually, there is something of an inverse relationship between fear and reason. But I also think that there is more to it than that alone. Suppressing fear has long been necessary, but it is something of a brute force method. There are better, more elegant ways to transcend fear, although they are difficult in the present world culture. He stopped and waited for someone to ask him to go on. He was not trying to tease them,
although that was the result. He wanted them to request the information. It bothered Julia if he just went on and on. He didn't have to wait long.
So, said Francis, what's the more elegant way?
Philip looked around the table and saw that the others were eager to hear him speak as well.
The more elegant way is to reverse the fear. Bear with me while I try to explain this. John's first epistle says that love casts out fear. The kind of love John mentions is called agape, the outward type of love.
Wait a minute, said Francis, you're losing me. I have two problems here. First of all, you're quoting the Bible, but I know you don't hold it as true, and secondly, I don't know what agape is, and the outward type of love.
Fair enough. Do you guys mind if I explain some more?
Not at all, said Michael.
I'd like to hear it.
Julia looked at him and said, Go ahead, Philip. Ramble on. It's painful to see you stop and ask permission all the time.
He winced, took a breath, and started back up.
All right. First of all, you are right, Francis. I do not take the Bible as automatically true. These are, however, the writings of good men, and they contain some really interesting ideas. That is why I often refer to it. Now as to agape and kinds of love, one of the more interesting things I found in the Bible was that the Greek text uses several different words that are translated into English as love. English, which is usually a very descriptive language with many words, falls short here. As I see it, there are really only two primary types of love. In the Greek, one is called agape, the other philia. Some people include eros as well, but I think eros is better understood as sexual desire, libido. Phileo is when you say, I love that car. It is a statement that expresses a desired direction of movement, inward. If you philia the car, you'd really like to bring it to yourself. Even if you never intended on getting the car, you think it would be fun if you did. The motion is inward, reaching out and getting in. Agape is the primal desire to bless, to pour something out of yourself, creating benefit, to birth some sort of benefit into the universe out of your own substance. In my experience, the more of this kind of love you can experience, the healthier a person you became. In any event, this is the kind of love that John says casts out fear. Notice the movement here, outward. Have you ever noticed the movement fear causes? Withdrawal inward. People call this shrinking with fear, and that's a reasonably good explanation. Note the difference. Agape is outward, fear is inward. Agape is an outflow of the inner self. Fear is contraction.
But what about filio? Asked Michael. That's inward.
Philip thought for a moment and then said,
You're right, Michael. I did say inward. Perhaps inward gathering might be a better thing to say.
Yes, it moves inward, but it is not a shrinking of the inner self. Let's just call the inner self the spirit for convenience. Phileo reaches out for something to draw to itself. The spirit neither pours out nor contracts, though it does wish for something to be brought to it. Fear is shrinking of the spirit. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, back to love, casting out fear. If your spirit is flowing outward with agape, the inward shrinking does not occur. So fear and agape are opposites. It is during the outward movement that real human magic occurs. Fear is what restrains it. Fear is the enemy of the high and the beautiful. It does not allow the human spirit to flow outward, to contact, taste, and know the goodness in others, or to use the goodness in itself.